Welcome to Prevention 365 Podcast. Prevention is every day and every way. This is your host, Carol Almeida. And for today, we will be discussing harm reduction strategies. What is it in relation to drug use, abuse prevention and treatment? So we have for our guest, Theo Motzenbecker, outreach health educator of our very own ADAP health intervention program. Welcome, Theo.
Thank you.
Theo, drug use is a stark reality of American society. I know you are an outreach health educator. So kindly explain, how do you come to terms or how do you deal with that reality?
Thank you for the question. So I work in ADAP's health intervention program, and we come from a harm reduction perspective. So if you're not familiar with that, if anyone's not familiar with that, I know, Carol, that you are, that it's about meeting people where they're at, kind of accepting that there are people who use drugs, whether or not we like it, and that not everyone is ready to take the step towards sobriety, and some people may never be. But there are still ways that we can reduce the dangers associated with drug use. So meeting people where they're at, both kind of metaphorically, what they're ready for, what they need right now, and also in our case, often literally, going to places like methadone clinics, shelters, encampments, finding people who use drugs who don't have connections to the same resources as other people, and making sure that they have the tools to keep themselves kind of safer than they would otherwise be. And so for us, it's a lot about thinking about, other than the drugs themselves, what makes drugs unsafe? And it's a lot of things, actually. It's using quickly to avoid police. You know, if someone is injecting themselves and they're afraid a cop's going to see them, they're going to do it more quickly. They might not measure their doses carefully. They might use a little more than they otherwise would, or just, not clean as well. And not using a little more than they would can result in overdose, maybe not kind of taking the time to clean their skin, can put them at risk of just like bacterial infections, abscesses, things that seem a little minor, but can actually turn really serious. We've also got all over the US, but in LA in particular, the fentanyl crisis, this very strong opioid fentanyl. It is 50 to 60 times stronger than pure heroin, and it is just flooding the drug market. It's being laced into just kind of everything that's sold on the street. So people who might otherwise know their dose and feel like they can use in a way that at least keeps them alive are overdosing, and a lot of people are dying because their drugs are so much stronger than they anticipated. It's in heroin, it's in meth now, it's in pressed pills. It's just a really frightening situation right now. And also just stuff like lack of access to clean supplies. If folks are sharing, that increases their risk of HIV, hepatitis C. Even if they're reusing something like a syringe, or they're using a pipe, long past the point that it's kind of broken and dirty, then that increases risk of infection. And even just stuff like not being able to shower regularly can again increase that risk of infection. What we do is we do offer referrals to other services. We offer a service called Health Navigation that's about kind of a short-term goal setting and helping clients reach their goals, and through sort of like a short-term case management model and also a little bit of a counseling model. And we also do offer things like a syringe exchange. We offer clean glass pipes and even just things like hygiene kits, PPE, things that folks really need and don't always have access to. And since I'm talking your ear off, I'll say that another thing that we're really aware of is that The consequences for using drugs are often more severe for people with marginalized identities, particularly people with multiply marginalized identities. BIPOC are more likely to get arrested and face prison time than white people who use drugs, for instance. Even after there have been some reforms in this area, sentencing for crack cocaine is still a lot harsher than for powder cocaine. And, you know, of course, crack cocaine is associated kind of popularly with Black people experiencing poverty, whereas powder cocaine is more associated with sort of like white businessmen and, you know, club kids. But part of harm reduction for us is about kind of bridging that gap between the consequences for someone who's, you know, who's sitting at the intersection of different marginalized identities using drugs versus someone who has a lot of privilege, has a lot of access. I feel really proud that ADAP, which of course started from a kind of traditional recovery perspective and still does that really important recovery work, is also invested in harm reduction. I think it's very important and cool.
Yeah, Theo. Let me be honest with you. You know, an average person, much more, shall we say, generally the community, you would have parents, you would have, you know, the elderly, you know, you would have teachers, administrators. I think they'll really find it hard to wrap their heads around harm reduction, you know. So, how do you explain it to like, let's say, people, not people, probably an individual, you know, an individual who's a member of the community, shall we say, an average worker, an average student, parent, you know, teacher, how do you explain it without really sounding, oh my God, this is offensive? Are you, is ADAP condoning substance use, abuse? How do you explain it?
Thank you. Yeah, I think that's a great question. In my experience, the people who struggle the most with kind of harm reduction are people who have either been through recovery themselves or people who've maybe been a caretaker or a witness to a loved one's recovery. And I think that makes complete sense that, I mean, if you're someone who has really benefited from sobriety or you're someone who has been really harmed by drug use, that I think that's that in particular can make harm reduction feel a little like, what are you doing? Why are you enabling? But I'll start by saying that people take risks all the time, and we do find ways to mitigate them. So for instance, you know, there's riding in a car gives you a risk of car accidents. So seatbelts are a form of harm reduction. Wearing sunscreen is a form of harm reduction. Getting the COVID-19 vaccination is a really kind of pertinent form of harm reduction. And then in the realm of substance use, someone who might drink at a bar and then go home with a designated driver is practicing harm reduction. It's really, you know, it's something that's already baked into our lives. And it's about accepting that people are going to take risks and then finding ways to mitigate those risks, both to the individual and to their community. And I do want to be clear that we're not anti-sobriety or anti-recovery, just that not everyone is there. Not everyone's in that place. And we believe that people who aren't, or maybe aren't yet, still deserve to protect their health in the ways that matter to them. Mm-hmm. And there's an idea that I've encountered a lot that sort of you can't help people who use drugs until they're ready to help themselves. And I do want to say that a lot of the people we encounter do want to help themselves, and also they're not ready to stop using. So it's about kind of finding, like, what are those kind of stepping stones for those folks? You know, so someone can reduce their risk of HIV, hepatitis, and overdose, consequences related to jobs, related to housing, related to how they spend their money, related to their personal relationships while they're still using. And, you know, someone who goes from using kind of whenever, wherever, to maybe only using after work or never using in front of their kids or always having a buddy there who's going to call 911 if they overdose, has made a really positive change. And additionally, I do want to say that harm reduction is often a stepping stone to traditional recovery. This is a fact from the CDC. People who use syringe service programs like ours are 5 times more likely to enter drug treatment and about 3 times more likely to stop using drugs than people who don't. So it really is, I think, a thing that can go hand in hand with a sobriety-focused model rather than something that's kind of opposed to it.
Yeah. Theo, can you possibly, or for the sake of our audience, for the sake of our listeners, would you have, or can you share with us specific cases that you have encountered, and how did you go about the process of determining what specific harm reduction strategy to use?
I don't want to get too specific with specific clients, but I do want to talk about sort of general types of cases, if that's okay.
Yes.
Awesome. Thank you. So for people who want to keep using for any reason, but they come to us and they're concerned about their health, they're concerned about their safety, but they're just at like, I'm not interested in reducing, I'm not interested in quitting, don't even talk to me about it. And if you keep talking to me about it, I'm going to scram. For those folks, the best thing we can do is offer them safer ways to use. So that can include giving them a safe way to dispose of their used supplies and replacing them with clean supplies. Again, for that kind of disease prevention model, and also for keeping the community safe, keeping those used syringes out of trash cans, as well as educating them on safer use practices. And one thing that we do is train them how to reverse an opioid overdose using a medication called naloxone. So if one of their friends overdoses, then they can be there to administer that and just keep that person alive, because a person's not going to make different choices in the future if they're dead.
Mm-hmm.
And then one thing that we found with some folks is that sometimes we'll get someone who's like really excited about what we're doing, and maybe they're not ready to make kind of huge changes. And sometimes it's people who really have cut down on their use already, or people who have even become sober, but they're really excited about what we're doing. And we do find ways to sort of integrate people into our program in an informal peer educator kind of way. But people will sometimes become kind of go-to people in their communities for when someone is overdosing and needs help, or someone needs clean supplies, or someone, you know, needs to be connected to a resource that this person might be someone that members of their community will go to, and we can support them in that.
Yeah. So Theo, can you describe to us what an ordinary day for you looks like? An ordinary day, like, I mean, do clients come to you, or do you outreach? As your position title says, you're an outreach health educator. So is it clients coming or you going to your clients? Can you describe your day? Yeah.
Sure. For me, it's often going to clients. So some days it's a fixed site. So it's a site that clients know that we're going to be at the same time every week. Or every other week, and and I set up. I'll set up a table. I'll have all my supplies out. I'll put up a banner. I'll maybe in this heat, I'll put up a nice canopy for some shade, and I'll hang out there for 2 to 4 hours, however long we're scheduled. And often the same people will come back kind of week after week. Sometimes they'll bring their friends. And then I can check in on how they're doing and make sure that they're hooked up with the supplies that they need, maybe help them work towards a goal. Some days after that, maybe I'll go outreaching with a couple of people. So go drive around in one of the company vans and try and find some encampments, something like that. Some days we'll go somewhere like a shelter and do an educational workshop, maybe teach people how to reverse an overdose, something like that. some days at sites, I'll run a little support group. Mm-hmm. And then for the second part of the day, I'll come back to the office. We do have a lot of paperwork that we have to do for all the supplies we're handing out, and kind of have to justify to our funders where those are going. So I'll do that paperwork, and it also helps us evaluate kind of how successful we are, what we need to be doing differently, which areas we're meeting a lot of people in. And then it's usually just kind of things like meetings. I might do a training or something, or I might just, get prepped for the next day.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Busy.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But it's so concrete the way you describe it, Theo. It is so concrete. It is reality in general, right? Mm-hmm. It is reality. So, we're just getting around that ADAP is taking really a step further. I mean, I think ADAP has this reputation of being one of the pioneers in harm reduction strategy. Am I getting this correctly?
Oh, I hope so. Definitely, we've been doing it for a while. Terry Reynolds, who is running the HIP program, I think kind of pioneered this department and has been doing this work for 20 years, maybe more. So I know she's someone that other folks in our kind of larger California harm reduction community really know and really look to. So I'm really happy to be here.
Yes, and proud to.
We're also very proud to.
We're also proud to have you, Theo.
Oh, thank you.
We're also proud. So let me go now to what we call desired outcomes. Isn't it that, in the place where we're in our field, prevention, intervention, and treatment for substance use and abuse, we always have or would like ahead of us to have what we call desired outcomes to determine effectiveness of what we're doing or success of what we're doing. How do you measure it when we are in the field of harm reduction?
So I will say that the biggest marker of success is also the hardest to quantify, which is how a client feels. Do they feel empowered to make educated, thoughtful decisions about their own health? Does change feel possible to them if they want to make change? But of course, we can also look at behavior. We don't have to just go by what the person is feeling. So we can kind of find out, are they, for instance, using a new syringe every time that they use? Are they sharing a pipe, or are they making sure to use their own or use a rubber mouthpiece with it to avoid, infection? Are they testing their supply for fentanyl regularly? Do they keep naloxone on hand? Are they using with a buddy, or if they don't have a buddy, are they calling the Never Use Alone hotline, which is kind of what it sounds like? It's a hotline where they'll send an, they'll take your information before you use, they'll stay on the phone with you for a few minutes after you have used, maybe you've injected, and then just keep checking in with you, make sure that you're still conscious. And if not, then you've already given them permission to call an ambulance to your location if you stop responding. So do people get tested for HIV and hepatitis C? Are they getting abscesses? Are they getting fewer abscesses? Do they know what increases the risk of overdose and what to do in case they see it happen to someone else? And I will say there are also ways to look at a community and measure success from a public health perspective. So we could look at community rates of HIV and HCV, hepatitis C. And I will say that, again, according to the CDC, which I keep coming back to, use of syringe service programs points to a 50% reduction in HIV and HCV incidence. And with people who use medication-assisted treatment, that is a two-thirds reduction. So those numbers go kind of radically up as well. You can also look at just how many syringes do you see on the ground or in public trash cans. There have been studies that have now spanned decades that show that syringe service programs improve public health by reducing the number of used syringes left in public places. I should be clear that I mean decades worth of studies, not studies that have a length of decades. And I do also want to say that as sort of as far as the kind of community health aspect goes, that syringe service programs are also shown to not increase crime rates or raise the rates of drug use in a community. So it's a win-win-win situation in that way. But yeah, those are kind of some behaviors we can look at both an individual and community level to see if what we're doing is working.
That's very impressive, Theo. Thank you for elaborating on it, both individual and community level. I would say harm reduction is a public health platform, right?
I agree. Yes, absolutely.
It's a public health platform. You know, which reminds me, I was just reading an article on COVID-19, the new subvariant, and right now it's not just having mandates, but placing individual responsibility, and as an individual, you also have to track the level of COVID-19 cases in your community. And they said that one indicator is wastewater, you know, tracking or wastewater surveillance system for COVID-19. So which brings me, yeah, you see,
that's
you're
so
surprised.
Cool.
I mean, just as when I heard syringe exchange as a public health platform, I am also surprised, you know. So thank you for explaining to us. Thank you for explaining to us behavioral change, you know, brought about by the introduction of harm reduction strategies, both at the individual behavioral level and the community level.
That is
enlightening. Okay, Theo, that is so enlightening.
So
this is, you know, this is, shall we say, cutting edge. I would say our discussion is cutting edge.
I feel pretty cool now. I feel like a cool kid.
Us really to be, you know, to be at ease in discussing harm reduction and, you know, sharing it with the community. Look, this is not condoning, this is not enabling substance abuse, but it is dealing with the reality that we're facing, very much like tobacco, very much like smoking. Mm-hmm. Much as we want to prevent early initiation or youth from accessing tobacco and using tobacco, we still have the reality that millions of Californians are hooked to tobacco and vape products. Mm-hmm. They said that the number of Californians using tobacco exceeds, you know, is or equivalent to the population of 23 small states here in the United States, you know. So that's why there is need for what? Harm reduction, to deal with that reality. And so we're exploring tobacco cessation strategies.
That's so fantastic.
You know, I think the success of this discussion is very much bringing it down to the level of, you know, the community, bringing it down to the level of the general population or the common people, you know, that harm reduction, I mean, it doesn't stay there clinical or, right, it's not a trend, it's not whimsical, you know, but it's a necessity to deal with the reality alongside prevention with respect to, you know, with respect to resolving in a strategic manner substance use and abuse. So thank you for that, Theo. And you know, it's short, the discussion is short, it's brief but very substantive. So I would like, the floor is yours for your message, you know, to our audience with respect to, you know, it's a thought, it's a message that you would like to leave to our audience on how harm reduction strategies can really bring about change in people's lives and can actually transform people's lives, especially those impacted by substance use and abuse, for the better.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to do this. I could go on about harm reduction for actual hours, but I will limit myself. And I'll just say that I kind of go back to the idea that I often hear the idea that people who use drugs aren't going to help themselves unless and until they reach rock bottom. And I'll say that that hasn't been my experience, that people really do want to live with dignity and safety, even when, you know, one part of their lives or one or more parts of their lives may feel really out of control. And if you offer people tools to keep themselves and their communities safer, they will use them. And that's better for everyone. And it also, I think, can help people find a sense of control, kind of rediscover in some cases that urge to take care of themselves and that that love for themselves. And I think that that leads to some really beautiful places.
Thank you, Theo. Thank you for that message. Again, it's reclaiming, right? It's claiming and reclaiming our human dignity, our right to live quality life. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for this for this day, Theo. Thank you for spending time with us to discuss in a simple way, you know, very simple, very concrete, you know, what harm reduction is. It may sound to be clinical or academic at times, quite unreachable for, shall we say, the ordinary person. But now that you were able to break it down, you know, people see the light. People see the light in prevention. And of course, within that context, the large context of prevention is harm reduction. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Carol. I appreciate you having me on to talk about this.
Yes. And definitely, this won't be the first and the last. There will be more, you know. So we bring to a close Prevention 365 podcast, this episode on harm reduction strategy. Drugs are destroying lives. What do we do? Yes, we have answers to that question. What do we do? Very productively, very fruitfully, we have answers to that through harm reduction strategies. So thank you. And we are airing Wednesdays, meaning the Prevention 365 podcast is airing Wednesdays on the Believe Network. Also catch us on Spotify and Apple. These are streaming services, or on ADAP's YouTube channel, aadap.com. Thank you so much. And until next time.